superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Well, hey, Mr. Policeman.
If you've ever called the police, you're glad to see them doing their job. But what about the ones that don't pass muster and end up in another department?
The law requires law enforcement agencies to keep a personnel file and then share that file with other law enforcement agencies that might want to know what led to that officer leaving.
A special report investigates. Plus, they're a cover band turned original music artist with a familiar name. We'll catch up with Turn, Turn, Turn. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The primary job of law enforcement officers is to keep our communities safe, and if you've ever been the beneficiary of that, you appreciate that work. Police training programs are intended to develop those skills, but what happens if trainees don't pass muster, or they do but later run afoul of department rules, or worse, are dismissed? Should they be able to move to another jurisdiction and get a new job in law enforcement? 2 years ago, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law requiring law enforcement agencies to unseal employment records of officers who left under negative circumstances. Also, the State Department of Justice has compiled a database of officers that have been either fired or forced out that law enforcement agencies can check when considering hiring a new officer. The Badger Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog group based in Madison, has obtained a list of those officers now working in different jurisdictions, including four in our area. Here to discuss the findings is the Badger Project's managing editor, Peter Cameron. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Peter.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the specifics of which officers left and where they ended up, tell me about the law and the reasoning behind it.
Sure. So there was a law passed in 2021 by the Wisconsin State Legislature, came out of a work group in the post-George Floyd era there. And what it was trying to solve, or at least improve, was one thing that police departments and sheriff's offices and law enforcement agencies had done with a problem officer is rather than have a big fight, big legal fight to fire someone, the law enforcement agency would agree, okay, if you resign quietly, we will seal your personnel file. So whatever it was that you did that led to this severance ending your employment, we won't tell future employers, especially future law enforcement agencies that might want to hire you. So that was a way that, you know, you'd have wandering officers moving from one law enforcement agency to another. The law requires law enforcement agencies to keep a personnel file and then share that file with other law enforcement agencies that might want to know about what that led to that officer leaving the law enforcement agency. So it bans the sealing of personnel records. And the database that the state DOJ maintains, I mean, it's similar, but it's separate in that there's a full database that, like, if I'm a police chief and I want to hire somebody, I can check to see if they were fired or forced out from another agency. So they're similar, but not exactly, not quite the same thing. One is has to do with individual law enforcement agencies maintaining a work history. The other one is just like a statewide database.
So let's back up a minute. Why does it matter if an officer who, let's say, is either out and out fired or, again, doesn't pass muster or whatever, goes to work at a different department? And before you answer, people are fired from jobs every day, including journalists and nonprofit researchers, you know. So I have a flippant but a real-life example of a reporter who accidentally ran the obituary of somebody who not only was still alive but who was a friend of the publisher. And that reporter was fired, but he got a job somewhere else. And the same is true for teachers and plumbers and truck drivers. So why not track them as well? And actually, I would say, having been a daily newspaper editor, when somebody calls about somebody, generally you get the dates of their employment and that's it.
Right. And one argument I hear from people within law enforcement is that police and deputies should be held to a higher standard. And because we give them force over us, that's one argument for why we track law enforcement officers in the state that have had a negative severance with a law enforcement agency. Yeah.
Well, and that's a good point, because that reporter did not have a badge and a gun, and he couldn't pull people over. You know, again, that premature obituary was embarrassing, but it was not, pun intended, I guess, a matter of life and death, real life and death. So would this law or the database tell you about officers who leave Wisconsin departments and get a job in another state? We're thinking, of course, of Minnesota right across the bay from Superior. Or is it just, does it only keep track of those in Wisconsin? Since obviously the legislature in Wisconsin, or indeed the state, doesn't have any jurisdiction over Minnesota or Illinois.
Yeah, I don't know. There would have to be some sort of agreement between the two states. And the Wisconsin state legislature doesn't have any, like you said, doesn't have any jurisdiction over other states. But police officers need to be certified. They need to receive certification from the state. And so if a Wisconsin police officer was to go work in Minnesota, they would need a whole nother certification. So that makes it much harder to switch states if you're a police officer. It's, your certification is good across the state, so you can jump around to different police law enforcement agencies in the state, but moving across the border would be tougher.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Peter Cameron. He's the managing editor of the Badger Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog group based in Madison that's obtained from the state a list of law enforcement officers who've left one department under negative circumstances and are now working in another. Nearly 300 officers are currently employed in the state who were fired or forced out from previous jobs in law enforcement, and that includes some in our area. So what can you tell us about them, Peter?
Sure. So there's a long list of officers in Wisconsin who have been fired or forced out of one job and are now working in another one. There's about 300 officers where that's happened to them out of a total of about 15,000. So we're looking at about 2%. And I don't want people to think that these are bad officers or that they've done horrible things. A lot of them, they were hired, they were young, they were novices. And when you're a new officer, you're hired under probationary period. So in that point, you don't have union protections. The chief can fire you for really any reason. So we've all had jobs where the boss didn't like us. And if that's the case, you know, you're gone when you're in this probationary period. So, I mean, a lot of times these new officers, they're new at it. So they're not great at it, or they just need a change of scenery. Some officers don't thrive in an urban policing setting, but they might do better in a sleepier rural county situation like that. So that gets us to City of Superior Police. On this list from the DOJ of fired or forced out officers, there were two that previously worked at the City of Superior Police Department, and they did not pass their probation. So nothing, you know, that bad. They just didn't meet the high standards of the Superior Police Department. So one of those has moved on to the University of Wisconsin Superior Police Force. So again, probably just a lower profile, a little less intense job. And the second one has moved on to Bayfield County Sheriff's Office. Again, they're non-city jobs. Well, one is more rural. One is dealing mostly with a smaller, you know, campus area. So that's two from the Superior Police Department. The worst one that I found was an officer who had worked in Shawano, and he was accused of having a sexual relationship with another officer's wife. And he's now working in Hurley at the Hurley Police Department. These are allegations. He's never convicted. There's no crime committed. But also this officer was accused of sending sexually explicit messages while on duty. And he was now fired. He left prior to the completion of an internal investigation at Shawano Police. And so, you know, that's one officer that's still in law enforcement. The fourth officer, again, kind of little stuff. He was working part-time for the DNR, Wisconsin DNR, as a conservation officer. And there was a dispute over taking patrol vehicles home. And I guess there was a rule about taking patrol vehicles home. Apparently it was not really followed very closely. Again, according to this officer who was terminated by the DNR, and he's currently working at the Price County Sheriff's Office, but he was hired there around the same time as at the DNR. So I didn't get too far into the details of this, But I just don't want people to think that these are police that are beating people up. And sometimes that's the case. But in this case, it wasn't.
Well, I was going to ask statewide, and thankfully we don't have that case in our immediate area. Have you found some that are more egregious or really out and out criminal? You know, what are the more serious accusations or indeed charges you found statewide?
So some police officers out there we found with DUIs, one or even two DUIs. There's an officer, he's working for the sheriff's department in western Wisconsin, and he had been arrested twice, never charged exactly, not charged with felonies at least, for threatening his wife or his then wife, now his ex-wife. There was one officer who was getting in trouble a lot in his youth for sort of drunken fights and things like that. And, you know, sexual harassment, things like that, where they were forced out of one department and then end up in another one. One thing I should say is that, like most fields and most professions right now, there's a shortage of workers. There's a shortage of job applicants in the law enforcement field. And, you know, part of that, I'm sure, has to do with in the post-George Floyd world, law enforcement, not the most popular job to be in. People maybe a little hard on law enforcement. But of course, there's a shortage of workers everywhere across the board. Is that leading police chiefs and sheriffs to lower their standards for hiring officers? I mean, maybe we're at a record, near record low for just total law enforcement officers in the state. And so, you know, when supply goes down, you may have to lower your standards a little bit. There is that pressure on hiring, whereas in 20 years ago, there used to be tons of applicants for law enforcement positions, and now they're just getting just a handful. So that's a problem that police chiefs and sheriffs have to deal with now and might be leading them, forcing them to consider some candidates that they wouldn't consider in the past.
You've reached out, I believe, to the officers or their new departments. What did they have to say? How are they working out?
Yes, I think two of the four that I reached out to that I wrote about got back to me and wrote me responses. And I should say that most of the officers on this list, their current bosses, their sheriff, or their it was complimentary, said they're doing a fine job. So, but I mean, one officer, she said that she just I guess it just wasn't a good fit for her at Superior. She said that Superior Police just wanted her gone. They didn't. It was a personal problem, and that she wasn't allowed to thrive there. So I didn't get too much into the back and forth, but we wanted to give everybody a chance to say their piece. The officer that had been fired by the DNR mentioned that while he was taking this vehicle home, it was something that other officers had done. And that while they told him he had been warned against doing this, he said he hadn't. So.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote this up, so your written report has appeared in the Superior Telegram.
It's also on our website at thebadgerproject.org. You can read it there as well.
I take it this wasn't a completely easy thing to do. The list wasn't just sitting there for you. So how did you accomplish it?
The list of officers who have been fired or forced out is obtainable by open records requests. I mean, the average Jane or Joe is not doing a lot of open records requests, but, you know, as journalists, we do that more often. So we obtained it from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And then we comb through it, and the list tells you previous employer and just gives a little bit of information, whether they were terminated or resigned in lieu of termination or resigned prior to completion of an internal investigation. So that's where we found these names, and we've done this for different regions of the state as well. And one thing I should say is that this work, our work that our journalism we're doing in northwestern Wisconsin is funded in part by a grant from the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation.
Mm-hmm. One more thing, too, is you mentioned George Floyd a couple of times and reforms that happened afterwards, or at least conversations about them. So the state law came as a result or during that time period post George Floyd after his killing. But the legislature was Republican. And again, you are a nonpartisan. You don't take sides on any of this. But generally, the emphasis goes the other way, right? It's the Democrats have been calling for a little more police reform than Republicans. Am I correct about that? Or is that kind of unusual?
No, I mean, I think that's fair to say that generally Republicans are maybe more pro-law enforcement. But this was kind of an interesting thing with the legislature. You know, you have the Republican-dominated legislature. And in post-George Floyd, there was a working group of Democrats and Republicans, and they put out a few different bills that the governor signed that were, you know, sort of seen as maybe law enforcement reform, like this one. Mm-hmm. And it was a little controversial, maybe, but that Republicans doing something that I don't know could be interpreted as going against one of their constituencies. But it was the bills themselves were uncontroversial. And in fact, there was actually a leaked email from Jim Steinke, who was in Republican leadership, where he was talking about how this is not a political winner for Republicans, but it's sort of the right thing to do. So that was kind of interesting as well.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that as a positive note to end on of cooperation between our erstwhile adversaries doing what they were elected to do and coming up with something they could agree on. So we've been speaking with Peter Cameron. He's managing editor of the Badger Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit watchdog group based in Madison. He's obtained a list of law enforcement officers who left one department under negative circumstances and are now working in another, including a few in our area. Thank you for joining us, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a cover band makes a turn and a turn and a turn toward original music.
Seven kids on a railroad track, south of San Diego, the world on the back.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Most of us of a certain age are familiar with the song Turn, 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 which was originally a Shaker hymn based on the Book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, and later performed by Pete Seeger and most famously by The Byrds. It's been covered by many, and a former cover band turned original music artist has taken it as their name. Turn, Turn, Turn is the trio of guitarist Adam Levy and Savannah Smith and bass player Barb Brinstead, who've been described as Laurel Canyon meets 70s Nashville with hints of Fleetwood Mac and Buffalo Springfield and a lot of Twin Cities mashup of styles that created a Prince. They're bringing that sound to the Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth tomorrow night, October 28th at 7:30 p.m., and vocalist and bass woman Barb Brinstead joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Barb.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks for having me.
So I just described you both as a bassist and bass woman. Which do you prefer?
I think bassist is fine, or bass player. But I like bass woman. That's new.
No one says bass woman. That's why I said it, because you have bass man.
Let's use
and,
it.
You know, yeah, okay. Hey, you heard it here first. So how did you decide on the name, and have you performed the song Turn, Turn, Turn?
That's a very good question. Adam was the one who came up with it. I'm terrible at choosing band names, so I always let the other folks do that. But he came up with it because truly we started as a cover band, and that's what he wanted us to remain. And it was Adam and I who started the band together. Originally, his daughter Ava was the third voice, and then she couldn't continue doing the band with us. So he thought of Savannah, who was a student of his, but he was really adamant that this remain a cover band. And so the first several gigs were just cover songs. I mean, we have lots of cover material that we did because we were changing the material almost every week. But beyond that, I also think he just liked what the name evoked, which is what you said in the intro, which is sort of a Laurel Canyon. We've been leaning a little more toward Nashville lately, but really close harmonies, a lot of the late 60s, early 70s stuff. We love Fleetwood Mac. And so I think the name just sort of summed up what we were trying to bring to local audiences.
Mm-hmm. And was that one of your covers?
So funny thing is, it didn't start as one, and we tried really hard to master that song. And it was a lot more difficult. It's, you never really know. Sometimes you try a cover song, like a mama's and papa song with lots of harmonies, and sometimes we nail it. But in that particular instance, for whatever reason, we just felt that we didn't do the song justice. So we tried it a few times, and then we abandoned it. And that's our story, and we're sticking to it.
All right. And I'm wondering if there's a downside to the name, because I have to say, when I did a Google search, the birds and Pete Seeger came up first. You did beat out Ecclesiastics, although I don't know what that says, because you'd think that that one would be around. But yeah, any confusion or you know?
Yes. I mean, that there definitely is a downside. That is, when you say turn, 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 sometimes we've been booked into venues and people think that we're a birds cover band just because of the name. So that's definitely a downside. We've come up with an explanation that I think suits the name, and that is that we turn toward the past, we turn to the present, and we turn to the future, and then there are three of us in the band. So we're sticking with it.
Okay, enough on the name. I think we got that. We'll turn to something else.
Sure.
I mentioned all those genres, and you mentioned them too. So how do you really describe yourselves?
Oh, that's a really hard one. I mean, when people ask, I say we're Americana, which, as you know, working in music and radio, it's a pretty wide, it's a pretty big bucket that you can put yourself in. There are so many different styles of Americana. There's soul, there's more country, there's rootsy Americana. But we call ourselves original Americana. And I guess that gives us a little bit of leeway to sort of shift course if we want to. We always like to try new things and experiment. We're working on our third album now, which is definitely going to have more of a country vibe to it than the previous two albums. So we think that works fine, and we just like to do things differently from album to album.
Well, we're going to let listeners decide for themselves. We're speaking with Barb Brinstad. She's one third of the group Turn, 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 who will be performing at the Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth tomorrow night, Saturday, October 28th. So let's hear something. How about Stranger in a Strange Land? You want to tell us about that one?
Yeah, so that's a song that I actually wrote. And, 2020 and 2021, 2022 were weird years for everybody. There was a lot of turmoil happening locally and globally. And then in my case, a lot of turmoil happening personally. And I lost two younger sisters in a 7-month period. And so that song is really about dealing with grief in the midst of local upheaval in my town of Minneapolis, and then also in the midst of a global pandemic.
Well, here is Stranger in a Strange Land by Turn, Turn, Turn.
Thank you.
that was Stranger in a Strange Land by Turn, Turn, Turn. They'll be appearing at Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth tomorrow night, Saturday, October 28th. We're speaking with, we said basswoman, right? Barb Brindley.
Yes, I love that.
Right, we like that. So you were a cover band, we said past tense here, but is it safe to say you're influenced by the songs you cover? And I'm hearing a pretty distinct Tears of a Clown by Smokey Robinson and the Miracles at the beginning of that one.
Yes.
Tell us.
Yes. Well, here's the thing with that song. It started out sounding very differently than what you just heard. It was, I would say it definitely had a more folkier sound, but this is one way that we collaborate with songwriting, is that I'll usually come up with a rough draft and I'll send it to both Adam and Savannah. And, you know, Adam's been teaching songwriting for decades, and so he usually then kind of changes it a little bit, maybe plays around with the chords, maybe suggests a different melody line or some different lyrics. And we sort of work through it until we get to something that we feel like we can do a demo of. And in that case, the bass line and there was no guitar line, they sounded very different. And I wanted something that would help move the song forward. And the bass is really good at doing that. And so I kind of came up with what I would call like an inverse Tears of a Clown bass line. Mm-hmm. So I can see why you hear that. And it was, as you know, Tears of a Clown, that bass line really helps move that song forward.
Oh, definitely. So you hinted at it just now. I talked about Adam's writing and his teaching. What are your background?
So, well, Adam has played music really since he was a teenager, and he's very well known in the region, if not nationally as well. He fronted a band called the Honey Dogs that was very successful for many, many years. He's also done a number of other projects, and the Professors. He had a kids band called Bunny Clogs. It's a play on the word honey dogs. And now he is a high school teacher at the St. Paul Conservatory for the Arts.
And yourself and Savannah?
I started playing music when I was in my teens and 20s. Also started as a guitar player, singer, songwriter, and then picked up bass. And then I put music on the back burner for about 15 years while I got married, had a child, went back and got my master's degree, and then focused on my career in marketing and communications. And then I decided I wanted to go back to music. And so I started studying bass very intently. I hired a great bass teacher named Jim Anton. So as I was getting better at playing, people were noticing me, and that's how Adam and I eventually connected. So I took a long break from music and came back, and now I'm both feet in, and I'm not going anywhere.
All right. And Savannah?
And Savannah, she also has a history as a singer-songwriter. She's been writing her own material and touring. But what she also did during the pandemic is that she opened her own vintage clothing store in downtown Eau Claire called Seven Sons Vintage. She's got that also occupying her time.
And I see she also was in a group called Leaving Eau Claire, but you just told me she hasn't left Eau Claire. So let's hear another one. How about Seven Kids? There has to be a story behind that.
Yes. So you want me to tell this story? If only I knew what it was, Robin.
Well, no, briefly, yes.
No, I mean, I know that song. It was definitely, there was so much turmoil going on in our worlds when we wrote all of this material. Mm-hmm. And so I know that that song is really about, you know, guiding the listener into a potentially a different world than they're used to existing in. And how do I fit in?
Good enough. Well, let's hear Seven Kids by Turn, Turn, Turn.
Some water and a meal and a place to stay. south of San Diego, the world on their backs, and their parents hope they'll be safe.
And that was Seven Kids by Turn, Turn, Turn. We're speaking with basswoman Barb Brinstad. And there's more than just the three of you, because I'm hearing a drum and maybe other instruments.
Yes, we have a wonderful band. When folks are lucky enough to attend a full band show, they'll get treated to drums and pedal steel, keyboards, and then sometimes banjo and guitar.
All right. And where can we find out more about your music?
You can go to our website. It's turnturnturnmpls.com. There should be a link that shows what shows are coming up, and we try to keep that up to date.
All right. How about one more to take us out? Hymn of the Hater?
So Hymn of the Hater is again, it's sort of about all of the reactionary stuff that was happening in 2020, 2021. Hymn of the Hater is trying to make sense of what's going on.
All right. We've been speaking with Barb Brinstad. She's one third of the group, Turn, 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 who will be performing at the Sacred Heart Music Center in Duluth tomorrow night, Saturday, October 28th. Thank you for joining us, Barb.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
It's just another Friday night in Boise. Since the paper factory closed, no one can sleep. There's a plastic bag blowing in the winds of change. A drunken man is stumbling down an empty street. I see them in the papers.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And our own Danielle Kading of WPR News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, if you're a boat watcher, you might see more salties than usual laying up in the harbor. And this is related to the United Auto Workers strike?
Yeah, that's right. Canada's largest private sector union is resuming talks with Canadian Seaway officials today to resolve a labor strike affecting shipment of goods between the Great Lakes and overseas ports. Nearly 400 Unifor workers are asking the St. Lawrence Seaway Management Corporation for better wages, and the strike began Sunday on the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway. More than 100 vessels are said to be waiting to enter the 2,300-mile waterway, according to Canadian Seaway officials. And Jason Roan with the Duluth Seaway Port Authority says the closure has had widespread negative consequences for Great Lakes ports, terminals in the Port of Duluth Superior, workers, cargo owners, and all the industries that rely on the system to move products. Only one ocean-going vessel, the Isadora, was at the port this week loading wheat that's bound for Algeria. But Roan says several Southeast are set to arrive, or ocean-going vessels, and it's unclear what will happen once they load cargo and depart. And he said an extended strike could also affect the port's monthly liner service between Duluth and Antwerp, Belgium. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority says Seaway officials have estimated a mid-season shutdown like this may cost $50 to $80 million a day for the two nations' economies, and it's the first strike-related mid-season shutdown since 1968, so the first in more than 50 years. Another 2020 study by Pennsylvania-based Martin Associates examined the economic effects of an extended closure on the Seaway tied to high water levels, and that analysis estimated a closure of 2 weeks during the middle of the shipping season could result in the loss of around 19,000 jobs and nearly $1.6 billion in economic activity for both the U.S. and Canada. And that looks at not just direct jobs, but also indirect jobs and other jobs that might be affected surrounding that waterway. And so we'll see what happens with these talks as they're set to resume.
Well, last week you reported on changes at the Department of Natural Resources Board. Now there's a change at the top.
That's right. The head of the agency that oversees environmental regulations and natural resources in Wisconsin is resigning next week after serving less than a year. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Designee Adam Payne said in a letter that he will step down November 1st, spend more time helping his wife with his aging parents, and focus on his own health and well-being. Governor Tony Evers first appointed him in December. An Evers spokesperson said the governor is working quickly on finding a replacement. Payne called the decision bittersweet, and during his time with the DNR, one of his major commitments has been addressing PFAS contamination. The current two-year budget includes $125 million to deal with the chemicals, but a Republican plan for spending it has so far drawn opposition from the agency, business, and environmental groups. Meanwhile, Payne's time at the DNR has also been marked by clashes with GOP lawmakers over wolf management, and the Senate just fired four of Evers' appointees to the policy-setting board for the DNR. The Senate had yet to confirm or reject Payne as DNR secretary.
Well, you just mentioned the wolf hunt controversy, and there's a decision on it.
Yeah, that's right. This week on Wednesday, the policy-setting board for the DNR approved the agency's contentious wolf management plan. The DNR's plan contains guidance to maintain the population between 800 and 1,200 wolves. Environmental and conservation groups support that plan, but GOP lawmakers have advanced a bill to force the agency to set a hard statewide goal. Some hunters and farmers have urged the DNR to maintain its existing goal of 350 wolves to reduce wolf conflicts with livestock and dogs, primarily in northern Wisconsin. And DNR large carnivore specialist Randy Johnson told the board that the range that they've developed gives opposing sides reassurance that the agency isn't looking to drastically increase or decrease the population. And he added the plan sets a solid scientific foundation that would give federal wildlife regulators confidence in the state's ability to manage wolves if the animal is delisted. Some animal rights groups, however, say that they oppose any unofficial cap on the wolf population, and Wisconsin tribes oppose hunting wolves because they view the animal as a brother and believe that their fates are intertwined. Even so, some tribal leaders say that the plan strikes a compromise by providing buffer zones to prevent hunting around reservation boundaries and protection of wolf dens. The DNR's revised plan includes six updated wolf management zones that would set harvest quotas to maintain, grow, or reduce wolves within those zones when the animal isn't listed as an endangered species. And the board also approved harvest regulations tied to its plan that reduces the time to register wolf kills from 24 hours to 8 hours after harvest, as well as issue zone-specific tags. Dog training to hunt wolves would also only be allowed when wolf seasons are held in line with state law, and training would end in each zone as they're closed to harvest.
All right. Well, Rick, moving to the Minnesota side, the cleanup of one of Duluth's biggest industrial sites is finally nearing completion.
Yes, it is. City leaders got a sneak peek of the progress being made at U.S. Steel Corps' former Duluth work site via train. Lake Superior Mississippi Railroad crew made a special trip down its waterfront line to provide a closer look at the $165 million project. Project manager Mark Loomis said the costs will be split, with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency picking up 49% of the tab and U.S. Steel paying the remainder as part of a cost-share agreement forged under the Great Lakes Legacy Act. U.S. Steel operated a sprawling industrial complex on the banks of the St. Louis River from 1902 until 1974, leaving the property to sit fenced off and idle for decades. It was designated a Superfund site due to contaminants left behind long after the buildings there had been removed. Duluth Mayor Emily Larson said the cleanup project not only provides for a safer, cleaner site and river, but also will open the area up for new recreational opportunities. She said that when the project is complete next summer, the city will open up a 92-acre restored and permanently protected riverfront green space. While U.S. Steel has been talking and developing plans for the site with federal authorities since 2011, the actual physical work on the massive restoration project began in earnest 38 months ago. The project extended into the river, where 138 acres of habitat are being restored with the introduction of more than 360,000 native aquatic plants. Officials acknowledge, though, that it will take years for those plants to truly become established.
Well, with the demise of heavy industry, healthcare is one of the region's main economic drivers these days, and there's a big investment coming.
Yes, Aspirus Health plans to invest at least $300 million into St. Luke's over the course of 8 years, provided a merger agreement receives approval from the feds. The Wisconsin and Duluth-based health systems on Monday announced they had signed a definitive agreement that moves the two organizations closer to a formal merger. The planned affiliation has been in the works for several months, with the two parties first announcing a letter of intent in July. The capital investment in strategic projects at St. Luke's was among the terms that were approved by a board of directors at both nonprofit organizations, officials said in a joint news release. The agreement also calls for Aspirus to implement standard software systems within 2 years to promote integration and efficiency. That includes Epic, which is the leading national provider for patient medical records. Aspirus additionally plans to expand healthcare insurance into the St. Luke's service area within 2 years. And all six unions representing St. Luke's staff have signed letters of support of the agreement. And Aspirus has committed to honoring all physician, labor, and union contracts and said it looks forward to providing new growth and development opportunities for all St. Luke's team members.
All right. And to stay out of the hospital, you might want to stay out of the cold, but maybe it won't be so cold this winter.
Well, there's a good chance the Northland will be warmer than normal this winter with a very slight chance of less precipitation. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration last week in its annual winter outlook. That's largely thanks to El Nino, which produces above average Pacific Ocean surface temperatures that influence weather across North America. The last three winters that we have all been La Ninas, when the Pacific waters are much cooler. But if you're hoping for a total reprieve of frigid temperatures and heavy snow, you might want to look elsewhere. El Nino doesn't mean that there won't be cold air outbreaks, and the intensity and frequency of winter weather events cannot be predicted yet. The model's prediction covers December through February. Climate change, of course, plays a role too and is factored into the forecast. The Great Lakes region already is warming and changing faster than much of North America and will continue to do so as global warming increases. In the Northland, climate change has meant higher overnight low temperatures year-round. While a warmer atmosphere means it can hold more moisture, leading to more snow, there are fewer days with at least 6 inches of snow on the ground. Mixed precipitation events are more likely, too. Years with much lower than normal ice cover on Lake Superior are becoming more frequent. This is according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and its climate change indicator of the Great Lakes. And that can only be heightened by a strong El Nino.
All right. And Rick, a familiar downtown landmark has changed hands, and you're getting a new office for us to come visit you.
Yes, we are. The sale of the Duluth News Tribune building was made official on Tuesday. Duluth Public Schools purchased two parcels, including the 64,000 square foot building and parking garage from the News Tribune's Fargo-based owner, Foreign Communications Company, at a cost of $600,000. The News Tribune has until late November to transfer operations from 424 West 1st Street to its new location at 222 West Superior Street. That is known as the Minnesota National Bank Building. The new location is also the former home of the Duluth Budgeteer News and is next door to the former Duluth Herald Building. The Duluth School Board voted in July to acquire the building, and the district intends to use the space for Duluth adult education and community education, as well as for facilities and storage from the district's Garfield Avenue property. Additionally, the district is also discussing the future of the Area Learning Center, Academic Excellence Online School, and Welcome Center in the building. While the doors to the News Tribune have been closed to the general public since the pandemic began, the news and advertising staff have been working from the facility, both on-site and remotely. The News Tribune signed a 5-year lease for the 5,000 square foot space on the Superior Street level of the Minnesota National Bank building, owned by Platinum Properties. News Tribune staff will be working remotely during the transition, but they're anticipated to return to the office in early December after interior renovations of the new space are completed. The relocated News Tribune office is expected to open to the public in January.
All right, well, we'll start the New Year's off with a visit to you in your new office, Rick. We've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Turn, Turn, Turn. Stay safe, everyone.
Carelessly who walks around, she's lost among her thoughts and found gambling tables and streets of ill repute. She descends a spiral staircase into the abyss and tries to face her fears and